rooms above the den. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello and welcome to episode 298 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Las Vegas, Nevada. I am Andrew Brokus, joined by Nate Mavis in Melrose, Massachusetts.
Melrose, Massachusetts.
Awesome. Well, let's get down to it. I know, Nate, you're on kind of a tight schedule here, but I'm very grateful that you made time to talk to me about this because I'm very excited. My book, Play Optimal Poker, should be available for pre-order by the time you are hearing this, and the launch date is Tuesday, June 4th. So quite possibly it'll be available for purchase by the time you're hearing this. And there's, you know, just when I do a significant thing in poker, one of the first things that I want to do is talk about that thing with Nate Mavis.
It's very kind. I won't say I've had a chance to read the whole book, which is like rather amazing that there are books of yours I haven't read in full, but life's been crazy. But this podcast isn't about me. It's about how great your book is. And I can say that from having read portions of it and skimmed all of it, it's really clear. And I'm also not fully up on the poker literature these days, but I think it fills a gap. I think a lot of poker players will get something out of it. I think sort of weekend warrior types will improve if they read and think about the book. I think, 5-10 pros, 10-25 pros, will also, you know, improve if they read the book and think about it. You know, I think there's a lot of stuff here. I think it's presented well. I think it's like sort of pleasantly, concise. And yeah, I think it's like sort of conversational and intelligible without being overlong or annoyingly chatty or anything like that. Like it's pretty
people are gonna be shocked after listening to this podcast. Annoyingly yeah. Chatty is my middle name, but yeah, I tried pretty hard to edit the book down. It went through honestly like the amount of there's no way that like the last 50 hours I put into this book were plus EV in terms of like generating additional sales. But I may not write another book or undertake another project of this scale, and I want it to be something that I can feel proud of. And my experience from having, I don't know, just like read interviews with various authors, not necessarily like poker authors, but just even like the very greatest writers of all time. It seems like, it's a pretty universal feeling that when something goes to print, it's never like exactly where you want it to be. You know, people are never like, oh, it's perfect. It's just what I was hoping it would be. I don't know where I was going with that. Yeah. I mean, a lot of work went into trying to make it match the vision that I had for it when it started, which was, all those things that you mentioned. Clear was a word I was particularly glad to hear you you use in there.
Yeah. No, it's good. And writing the book is good, and you're probably right that the last 50 hours did not net you money, even like when you consider intangible long-term benefits. But that is definitely also true of the last dozens of hours I put into my books, and I do not regret those hours. Probably it's also true of you in previous things you've done. Like, I think you're going to be grateful. I think you will be more grateful for having brought the books closer to your vision than you would be grateful for the extra, $1,000 you would have made or whatever during that time.
Yeah, I think that's right. The idea of having a book out there that I didn't feel good about would be like an embarrassment. It wasn't like an embarrassment. Like that's overstating it. But yeah, I wanted it to look nice. It is self-published, but I don't want it to look like a janky self-published book. It's going to have a pretty professional look to it, and just a lot of rounds of revision went into writing it down, you know, I'm grateful to a number of my students and some people who have had some correspondence with this show who are mentioned in the acknowledgments were very generous in reading and suggesting some of those changes as well. But, you know, I can be wordy as I'm being right now. And I went to great pains to really cut the fat from the bone in the book and just, you know, get it down. There's a lot of content. It's like 243 pages, I think, is the final count in the paper version. And there's some, you know, like I tried to put some white space in there because it is kind of dense content, but there's a lot in there in those pages. Like I think there's stuff that, you know, it's a single page in the book, but that, you know, I could do an entire, you know, 1 hour coaching session on talking about that one page.
Yeah. No, there's a lot there. And like, I think it's good. I think you did well. I think you should be proud of yourself.
That's very nice to hear. Thank you. It's actually been, this morning in particular has been kind of stressful up until like the 5 minutes before we got on the call. So, this is kind of like minutia of a publishing on Amazon, but I think people may find it kind of interesting. So first off, to set up a pre-order, you can only do this for ebooks. You can't, as a independent publisher, random as it were, you can't have a pre-order for a paper book, which once I read the explanation for that made a lot of sense to me, which is that a lot of people don't actually meet, you know, they put a thing up for pre-order and they set a date for when it's going to be available, and you have to upload something, but it's often like you're not required to upload the finished book at the time that you make it available for pre-order. So what happens is, you know, a lot of people who are like first-time self-publishers don't actually hit their deadlines, and people get a bunch of janky like half-finished books, and then they complain. And if it's an ebook, they get their money back. No, but, you know, they're just like, hey, this book isn't actually finished, and Amazon just like refunds everyone's money, and it's fine. You know, for a paper book, that's a much bigger problem. If someone gets like a half-finished, you know, garbage paper book, then they have to, you know, there's like shipping costs and stuff that have to be reimbursed, and that's a much bigger issue. So I think it's perfectly reasonable from their end that they don't let you do it. But there's some restrictions around pre-ordering that even for the ebook, they have to like approve it once you put it up for pre-order, and there's kind of like a window. So like my deadline was midnight Greenwich Mean Time for when I was allowed to make changes once I had uploaded a kind of preliminary version of the document. But then they wouldn't let me make changes to the document until they had like already approved the preliminary one. So it was kind of like down to the wire whether I was even going to like have the opportunity to make changes. And then I got literally like 10 minutes before I was going to get on the phone with you, I got the email from them that like it had been, so I had to kind of quickly jump in there and like upload the version that I actually wanted them to use. But I think I did get that in under the wire. So that was
nice.
But there's been a lot of like things like that that are just like come up where you're like, oh, actually this thing is going to be a huge hassle that you thought was going to be trivial.
Yeah. Well, good for you.
Footnotes,
good for
putting you. Those numbers at the bottom of the page and having them not appear on certain pages, headers, those sorts of things. That was really a lot to like actually get those right.
Yeah. I remember having some Unicode issues like when I was, and I wasn't doing anything like pre-orders or whatever, but, I do have two self-published books on Amazon, and like there were Unicode issues, and there's this like whole thing that's conducted in a vocabulary all its own. A lot of acronyms I had to learn to get through that process.
I learned a lot about Word. I'll say that. I guess there's that same, like most people only use 10% of the features on Word or whatever. And I think I'm
fewer
now. there's a lot of neat stuff. I mean, it's sort of frustrating to like, if you don't go in like setting up the document knowing that you're going to be using these formatting tools, it can be kind of frustrating to like go back after the fact and make it play nicely with them. But when you understand like what it's meant to do, you can see how powerful it actually, like I've always just been kind of frustrated by how Word kind of like auto formats things like bullets and whatnot, but like when you really see the mechanics of what that's meant to do and like how useful it is in a huge document to just be able to, you know, one click change all of the headings to be a different font size or something, it's pretty this is a valuable tool.
I'll spare everyone a rant about enterprise software and like, you know, various issues around that, but Word it's cool to be a Word power user.
So you mentioned something earlier about who would benefit from this book, which it was interesting. The initial impetus for my writing it was just kind of a pet peeve that I'm sure I've mentioned on the show before, a lot of like misunderstandings about game theory and kind of the idea that game theory is something that's only applicable for either, you know, if you're playing against like really elite opponents, or I guess another one is game theory doesn't really matter unless you're going to be playing with the same people like over and over and over again, or just a lot of like misunderstanding. The word balance gets thrown around a lot with no real clear understanding of what that means. Plus some like misunderstandings that I had at some point when I first read a book like Mathematics of Poker. And I think that game theory is actually a really useful like lens for understanding poker. And it's not to say that, you know, when you play, you're actually trying to replicate a Pyo Solver output or something like that. In fact, there's very little like actual discussion of Pyo Solver in the book. It's a lot more just trying to understand, really, even in some cases, poker strategy where the actual strategy might be something that people already know or half know, but they don't understand the reasons for it at all. Like, why do we check to the preflop raiser? Why is that a thing? And then, you know, how, once you understand why that's a thing, you can understand how to approach a lot more situations. So, you know, what I'm really hoping to do, and the Weekend Warrior was kind of who I had in mind when I first wrote the book, was, you know, to just give people a better understanding of like how to think about poker strategy for themselves. So it's not a, you know, when you're in this situation, do this kind of book, or like, here's a neat move, here's a time when you could consider check raising the turn. Like it's not a book about like moves and plays. It's a book about understanding where those things come from, and about, you know, how to analyze any situation that you might find yourself in. But what I found in writing through the book and talking about people is, as you said, there's actually a lot of professional poker players who don't know this stuff either. And, you know, their ability to implement based on experience is a lot better. But, you know, a lot of those misunderstandings that I just delivered, I mean, you can find very successful professionals who have those same misunderstandings about game theory.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I also think that, like, some of the stuff that'll be applicable for, like, higher stakes, even people who are like doing very well at higher stakes games, is thinking in terms of like situations, or, you know, is less like you telling them things that they don't know. Well, although there will be some of that, and more you encouraging them to think in ways that they might not be thinking. One example I have in mind is, you know, considering the value of a situation. And I think most people understand that some situations are good and some situations are bad. But like, when you actually get to thinking about like what's the value of the situation for player A with range X against player B with range Y, then you start thinking like, oh, how do I enter my whole strategy so that more good situations happen? And that's something that like a lot of really good players do, and that's what makes them really good. But I think a lot of really good players don't like sort of take that next step, and like they know what they should do with hands, but they sort of don't think overall like, oh, I'm gonna make money in this game by getting into this specific situation because it's really valuable. And I think it's sort of a leak on the sort of meta level of analysis that a lot of like very strong players have, and I think that that's something that they will improve by reading your book.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't think explicitly about what kind of situation am I trying to create. I mean, passively, I think it's going on at like a subconscious level or whatever, like when, you know, they in order to 3-bet aces, and it happens that 3-betting aces like creates one of those kinds of situations. But I don't know that people could really, you know, extrapolate from that to 3-betting other kinds of hands. There's like any other sort of scenario. I guess what you said, like the meta level of thinking about it, of what am I trying to accomplish? Like, where does my profit come from at poker? And it doesn't really come from getting dealt aces, or it doesn't come from getting dealt sets. I mean,
One thing that I think about it is like the Ed Miller funnel, where you have all your hands at the beginning of the hand, and then at showdown, you have few of your hands. And like, where do you fold them? And, you know, like one thing that helped me think in this way better was playing Limit Hold'em live against the same people for a year, which I did once. And then you start to think like, oh, this guy goes crazy on the turn. So like, you know, there's a lot of ways to fight against that. But like, you know, one thing you can do is just like counterintuitively to some people, tighten up a little bit, get to the turn with like 83% as many hands, and then like, you know, just like somewhat, you know, just sort of trim off the bottom of your range. And then like when he's going crazy, like you punish him, you smoke him, you just have like that many fewer of your marginal hands or bluffs and that many more of the hands that you can just blissfully three bet, and you just rake in the money, like so much money. Like it matters a lot more than like the pennies you're giving up on the flop, you know? But the idea of like sort of engineering your whole game around making a ton of money on the turn, say, or you know, doing something pre-flop, or you know, all sorts of things. I think that's valuable.
Yeah, one of the myths that I wanted to combat was that you know, game theory isn't useful exploitatively. You know, I actually think that and I play exploitatively most of the time. Like, it's not that common that I'm really trying to approximate the equilibrium when I'm playing poker, but I almost always think about the equilibrium because I find it's helpful to spot opportunities for exploitation. And you know, a big part of the book is about how do you go back and forth between those things. You know, how do you recognize, okay, my opponent is deviating from the equilibrium in this way, or I believe that he is, and what are the things I should do to take advantage of that? And it's easy to spot the obvious ones. Like, if you know that your opponent is bluffing too much on the river, then you probably want to call more on the river. But you know, there's more to it than just that. Like, that has implications for your turn play. If you know he's going to bluff too much on the river, you might want to get to the river more often with certain kinds of hands, or slow play more often. Or, you know, there's lots of stuff that happens down the game tree that's not just the single most obvious exploit. And I think that's one of the things, in addition to just like noticing new mistakes that you didn't even realize were mistakes because you didn't know what you sort of like optimal play would look like in that situation. There's also, I think, you can just open your eyes to new ways of taking advantage of mistakes that you've been aware of for a long time.
Yep, I think that's right. Yeah, like a lot of the time I don't drive the speed limit, like either slower, often slower, often faster. But I always want to know what the speed limit is.
So one of the things in the book that I'm most excited about, because it addressed something that was a big misunderstanding for me, and I think it is for a lot of people about game theory, is I know you're familiar with the Ace King Queen game, and I imagine a lot of people listening to this will be, but the basic idea of the Ace King Queen game is this kind of this very simple approximation of poker, where there's a three card deck, and each player is dealt either an ace or a king or a queen. And there's no draws or anything. That the objective is just have the highest card at showdown. And you introduce some betting, and you can kind of learn some interesting things about value betting and bluff catching. And you can find, and I show how to do this. You know, you can determine like you bluff to value bet frequencies and bluff catching frequencies. And it's a nice way to introduce the concept of indifference. The problem with it is that because it's such a simple game, it's hard to imagine how anyone could make a mistake in this game. Right? Most of your decisions are trivial in this game, or just end up not mattering very much if your opponent's playing an equilibrium strategy. So like, if you're facing a bet and you have an ace, okay, that hand is the nuts. It doesn't take a genius to figure out you should call the bet. And if you're facing a bet and you have a queen, that's the nut low. It doesn't take a genius to figure out you should fold the queen. And it turns out if you play an equilibrium strategy and your opponent's not a bonehead, you don't really show a profit in that game. Even though you're playing optimally, all you do is break even. And I think because that's a lot of people's introduction to game theory, a lot of people come away with the idea that game theory is just about breaking even. And in fact, there's a lot of ways that playing, even if you are only playing a kind of like balanced strategy, if your opponent's making sufficiently large mistakes, you can profit from those mistakes even if you're not actively doing anything to exploit them. I mean, it's better to do something to exploit them, but the point is, if you don't know what they're doing to actively exploit it, you can still profit from that mistake simply by playing an optimal strategy. And so what I did was I investigated a slightly more complicated version of the Ace King Queen game called the Ace to Five game, where there's 10 cards in the deck, Ace through Five, and a player could be dealt a random one of those. And so that introduces concepts like thin value betting, right? So now, you know, obviously you're going to bet the nuts when you have it, but how weak of a hand can you bet? Okay, you can bet a king, that's probably not too hard to figure out. A queen, a jack, a 10. Well, it turns out the player in position can bet a 10 facing a check, but the out of position player can't bet a 10. And then we can look into what are the reasons for that. So the optimal strategy in that game was a little bit more complicated than the optimal strategy in the Ace-King-Queen game. And if your opponent makes understandable mistakes, like not value betting quite as thinly as he could, or he calls when he has pretty good hands, but he doesn't call quite as wide as he should, or he bluffs with the wrong kinds of hands, the equilibrium strategy can profit from the opponent's mistakes. So that game enables us to see both how an equilibrium strategy can profit from mistakes, and it also enables us to actually look at realistic mistakes. Like, how do we deviate from the equilibrium to exploit an opponent who's value betting a little less thinly than they should be? Not making a huge mistake, but just missing some value bets that they could be making. Or a player who doesn't check raise bluff, right? That's a common one. We've probably all play with a lot of players who have that leak. So I think even a game that, I mean, it's still much closer to the Ace King Queen game than it is to real poker, but it's got just enough of complication to the Ace King Queen game that I think it enables us to investigate a lot more interesting situations about poker. That's one of the things in the book that I was most proud of, was kind of finding, I think it's still a very simple game, but it allows us to look at much more complex elements of poker strategy than the Ace King Queen game does.
Nice. Yeah. Well, so if it is on or after June 4th, you should run out and buy this book, yes. And if it's before June 4th, you can run out and pre-order the book.
Yeah, no need to run out, actually. There's it's probably not going to be in any physical bookstores. So the if you want a paper book, Amazon is the only place to get the paperback, and that'll be available starting June 4th. For an ebook, the Kindle version will be available through Amazon, and that's available for pre-order immediately. If you want other electronic versions of the book, which would be an EPUB that you could read on something like a Nook, or if you want a PDF, those plus the Kindle version will be available at nickcast.com. So the only thing you can get at nickcast.com is the electronic version. The upside of getting the electronic version at nickcast.com is you get all three. You get the Kindle version, the EPUB, and the PDF. On Amazon, you'd be able to get just the Kindle version.
Pretty slick. Congratulations.
Okay, gang. We may not have a strategy segment for you this week, but we still have a strategy sponsor. It's Tournament Poker Edge, and if you want poker strategy, you want more poker strategy, that's the place to go, tournamentpokeredge.com. You'll find dozens of videos from me, hundreds of videos from other instructors, all for as little as $25 a month at tournamentpokeredge.com. I guess I can also let you know, if you want to hear me talking strategy via Tournament Poker Edge, there's even a way to do it for free, which is on the latest Tournament Poker Edge podcast, which you can access from tournamentpokeredge.com, or I guess just Googling Tournament Poker Edge podcast. Clayton Fletcher, who's been a guest on this show several times, is the host of that show, and he had me on the show. I'm discussing the book on there as well, but we get a little deeper into strategy on his show, and I'm also discussing a hand from a Venetian Deep Stacks event that I played out here, part of the Poker Summer. So you can check that out as well at Tournament Poker Edge.
Devotion of a car, my light, the fair passage of a bill.